It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Later in the program, we'll talk with a guest who says we need more quiet in our lives if we want to get any decent thinking done.
First, there's a new push in Wisconsin to legalize the sale of raw milk, and a proposed bill in the Senate would do just that.
The bill is currently getting a public hearing at the Capitol. Supporters of legalization say it's about consumer choice and that there are health benefits from drinking raw milk, but opponents point to potential health risks from bacteria that can result from unpasteurized dairy products.
Sean Johnson joins us now. He's WPR's state government reporter. He's covering that hearing this afternoon. Sean, thanks for cutting out of the hearing for a minute to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So what would this Senate legislation do? How would raw milk be sold in Wisconsin if it were to pass?
It's a fairly short bill, and I think sort of the key thing to remember is that even if this passes, you're not going to have raw milk on supermarket shelves. This would legalize something that's going on right now, and that is direct sales of raw milk on the farm. So it would make it legal for a dairy farmer to sell raw milk on the farm to a consumer as long as they followed a few basic safety precautions. They'd have to provide it in a clean container. They'd have to print the name of the milk producer and indicate that it's not pasteurized. Post a sign saying raw milk products sold here, raw milk products are not pasteurized. So some fairly minimal stuff in terms of what they'd have to do. But it's not something where, you'd be able to go to the supermarket and decide whether I want to have a gallon of 2% pasteurized milk or the raw stuff. You'd have to go out and seek this out.
So some strange bedfellows on this one. West Bend Republican Glenn Grothman and I've heard Madison area Democrat Therese Brousseau are both in favor of this. Why is this bringing together people from the left and the right?
It's a great issue that way, and it was the last time it came up when Democrats were in charge of the legislature. You do have very unlikely alliances here, people who normally oppose each other and don't see eye to eye on anything at the Capitol. They tend to find some common ground when it comes to raw milk. I think there's, a real local food push among, many Madison Democrats or Democrats who might be inclined to support this. And then you've got sort of a libertarian bent among some Republicans in Wisconsin, including Glenn Grothman, who's not generally a fan of regulation, and so they have they have similar interests when it comes to raw milk, because a lot of the raw milk community views this as an issue of freedom. In fact, they're wearing hats at the hearing today that say "milk" on one side and "freedom" on the other side, and they've said that's primarily the issue here, is that gives people the power to choose what they want to put in their body, and gives farmers the right to produce this without being, basically within the network of the larger dairy industry.
You've been at the hearing today. I don't know if they've gotten to the point where public testimony has started. What kind of things are you hearing there?
You've got a pretty big coalition of groups that are lined up against this, including the dairy industry, the agriculture industry, so the Dairy Business Association, the Farm Bureau, among other groups. Cheesemakers, the medical community, the medical society, and a number of other, medical groups as well, nurses, pediatricians, they're all lining up against this. And so the bill's work probably, the bill probably has its work cut out for it. And then on the other side, you basically have the raw milk lobby, and it's not exactly a big lobby or well-funded lobby, but a passionate one. And the Farmers Union. And so kind of a David and Goliath situation as far as legislation like this goes. And so testimony has reflected that split. You've had doctors up there testifying that it creates an unnecessary risk, that pasteurization's been around for a long time for good reason, because of its safety benefits. And then you've had raw milk advocates up there saying, look, we drank this stuff as kids. Nothing ever happened to us. I sell this to customers. They're very happy. They seek me out because they like it. And, customers are looking for ways to kind of take their health decisions into their own hands. Raw milk has a lot of the bacteria, good bacteria in it that pasteurized milk, by definition, gets rid of. And so there are a lot of customers out there, consumers, that want that to make themselves healthier.
Governor Doyle vetoed a raw milk bill back in 2010. Have we seen any indication from Governor Walker as to what he would do with a raw milk bill?
He hasn't said, and you hear people saying this is a tough decision for him because, you know, he does enjoy, support from what you might still call the Tea Party wing of the Republican Party, or, those lawmakers and those voters who would like to sort of issue government regulation whenever possible. And then he does have a strong backing in the business community. The Dairy Business Association, the Farm Bureau both endorsed him. So, there's a little bit of a tug of war there for him. He hasn't said what he's going to do, but, generally he's been pretty favorable to the business community in most of his decisions. And, the people that are working for these organizations are professionals. They know how to deal with the governor's staff, the administration. And so they're going to find a way to get their message across to him.
Looking at the big dairy industry, the dairy organizations you mentioned, the raw milk supporters say that's definitely the David and Goliath angle. The big dairy associations don't want the competition. They want to dominate the industry. What's been the argument from the dairy association, though, when they oppose raw milk sales?
They say that Wisconsin has a brand that it's worked to develop. I mean, the dairy state is pretty well known, and a lot has been put into that brand. Dairy farmers have a lot of money riding on this. The state has a lot of money riding on this. And so they don't like the idea that if you have raw milk and if you have some sort of a health issue, that could taint the entire brand that Wisconsin has worked hard to build.
And so they don't want to see headlines, Wisconsin milk sickens 13 or whatever.
Right, right. The counterargument against that in the hearing from raw milk supporters has been, if that happens, I mean, people can differentiate between a raw milk outbreak and a pasteurized milk outbreak. I mean, the kind that you buy at the supermarket, and that they ought to be able to entrusted to make those decisions.
Sean, big picture, last time around, this was a big deal, man. This really dominated a lot of the news coming out of the Capitol. Now we've had a lot more big deals, Act 10, the protests in the Capitol, things like that. Do you think this is calmer and quieter this time around as they consider raw milk?
I wasn't up there for the public hearing last time. It wasn't held in Madison, and I think it was one of those public hearings that went all day. I think that the raw milk backers are probably as passionate about this today as they were then, although they can point to some recent victories, including a raw milk farmer who was basically who was charged and basically acquitted. And so, you've had some time pass. They've still been able to sell this product, although it's essentially contraband when they do.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Rob.
Sean Johnson is our state government reporter. I'm going to share a comment from our Facebook page, and you can go there to comment on this raw milk thing as well. Joe writes, if you're worried about E. coli, then the sale of leafy green vegetables should be banned. No one wants that. Raw milk, which is less of a health risk, much less, he says, should be legal too. What do you think about raw milk? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know what you think the state government should do.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the need for quiet in today's society. I'm Veronica Rickert.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Whether you live in the city or the country, it just often seems to be getting harder and harder to find quiet space to think. There's the traffic noise, the beeping of electronic devices, jets flying overhead. Our next guest says a noisy world is making it harder and harder to think.
George Prochnick joins us now. He's the author of the book In Pursuit of Silence, and his piece, I'm Thinking, Please Be Quiet, appeared as an op-ed in the New York Times recently. George, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on the program.
Well, you start your piece talking about Schopenhauer, who moved to the city and turned the pursuit for quiet into a kind of philosophical quest. Can you tell us about him?
Sure. Schopenhauer was one of the leading minds of the 19th century, and while he had always been someone who was what we would say today, sensitive to noise. It was when he moved into a larger city that he began to realize that there was a real philosophical problem with noise. And what he came to believe and to write about was that nothing distinguishes the philosopher, or indeed the person with any kind of serious thinking going on in their minds, from anyone else, except the ability to concentrate their thoughts entirely on one subject. And noise, he said, was the number one enemy of this power of concentration, because it shatters thought and sends it flying all directions. He compared it to the effect of a large army which was scattered helter-skelter over a countryside and thereby could not accomplish any of its aims.
Well, a lot of cultural observers today are worried about our shrinking attention spans. People talk about not being able, for instance, to read novels anymore. They have to read things that are shorter in bite-sized chunks on the internet. Do you think noise is part of that?
I think it certainly is, and it's particularly disturbing in terms of young people who grow up with these levels of acoustical assault that are just so beyond what any generation really has had to deal with in the past. You know, it's a bit of a tricky issue, because if we look at a city in the Industrial Revolution, a large city like London, it was possible that you would be living next to, say, a major manufacturing site. In a sense, it would be more likely than today because there was less urban zoning. But what you also had was more refuges of silence for the broader populace. It wasn't what it's become today that I worry about as more of a kind of boutique commodity luxury. I mean, if you have money today, you can find silence. But there are, as I found when I was researching the book, millions and millions of people who really move from loud homes to loud streets to loud shopping to loud schools, and they just have no respite from it. And it's the interruption of noise to give you time to focus yourself that seems particularly important for our cognitive and indeed our larger physiological health.
Now, my sense is that the world has gotten noisier. I walk into a restaurant sometimes and I can't even carry on a conversation with people because it's so loud. And I think that acoustically they're meant to be loud these days so that there's a sense of hubbub and things happening. But am I right about that? Is the world getting louder, or has it always been loud?
Well, this is precisely what I was starting to say in response to your last question. I think that it's tricky to make the case that it's louder in terms of decibel level everywhere, but what is the case is that there is less room to escape from the noise, and I think it's the envelopment in noise that is particularly damaging. I spoke with a number of teachers who talked about the hyperactivity of their children, all these issues with attention deficit, and many of them attributed it to the way that they were always plugged into something. There was never a moment really in their days when there wasn't some kind of auditory input going on that was really beyond what they could handle without getting jazzed up. And I think it's really important to remember that sound waves are a form of energy and they do pump us up. It's part of why in restaurants today, even it just seems de rigueur to have loud music, because people want that sense of a high energy as something stimulating to it. Not to conversation, but to how much people drink in particular, in the sense that they're having a good time. I worry that really there may be a kind of, at this point, almost a physiological addiction to noise. We know that noise can trigger the release of dopamine. And when I hear so many places that are so unnecessarily loud, gyms, for example, also, there's a clear sense that we're craving that energy and doing so at the expense of more reflective forms of thought and intimacy with loved ones and a whole range of concentration activities demanding concentration.
There's a whole lot of research out now that the human brain is pretty plastic, that it can change and adapt. And I wonder if it's still true, do you think, that we do need quiet to think, or do you think our brains will just adapt to things being noisier and that we'll be able to concentrate despite the noise?
I think that it is quite possible that that what's going on now, based on conversations that I had with neuroscientists working in various fields, that it's quite possible that this current level may be more than something we can process and adjust to. You know, and here we have to look beyond the specific auditory effects of noise at its larger impact on our cardiovascular system and our overall health. You know, our hearing is incredibly sensitive. It developed, mammalian hearing developed as an early warning system. The primate ancestors that our own hearing developed from were very small and navigating a world with lots of large predators. They were nocturnal, and noise was how they determined where a threat was in space and so that they could run away from it. We have this hearing that can actually amplify sounds in our ears from what they are in the atmosphere several hundred times. So we have this incredibly acute sensitivity that is so hardwired into us and so hardwired into us as something that has to be responded to as a threat that I don't know if we can really override this overall systemic response. You know, there's enormous evidence from WHO-funded studies, sponsored studies, and other very rigorous scientific studies that are looking at the risk heart damage and also all sorts of different kinds of stresses to our physiological system because of noise.
Well, and there's some interesting research that you write about, it's kind of scary research, too, about the effects of the noise that jet engines make flying overhead when people are sleeping. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. I was particularly struck by this because it's obvious, or relatively obvious at least, that for people who are woken by airplane traffic, that there's going to be some degrading effect on their health. But there was a very damning study done several years ago that looked at what the noise of air traffic did, even to people who managed to sleep through the sounds of jets overhead. And what these studies found was that even when there was no perception, at least, of waking, that there was a massive release of stress hormone, blood pressure elevated, pulse went up, there was vasoconstriction. All of the markers to the body being extremely stressed were caused, even when subjects remained completely asleep, as far as they knew at least, and worst, in a way, after these people left their homes for up to 6 hours afterwards, even if they worked in relatively quiet environments, those effects continued to resonate. And, you know, since it's 9-1-1, I'm going to just tell one very quick anecdote that speaks to this same issue. One of the worst areas of noise pollution today is actually noise pollution affecting marine animals because of shipping. And there were studies looking at stress hormones, different kinds of stress markers in whales that began in the late 1990s and were continuing in the early 2000s. In the immediate aftermath of 2001, there was an enormous drop in shipping in the oceans, and whales that were examined in the weeks following September 11th were discovered to have a radical drop in those stress hormone buildups that had been causing all sorts of disturbances to their migratory patterns, their feeding patterns, etc.
Wow. So, but you're saying we're not that different from whales. We pick up
on
the stress.
I'm saying we're not. And I think that the problem is we take for granted the situation that there's nothing that can be done about this onslaught of noise. And yet I believe that if there was more of a kind of political will to make silence something that was more democratically accessible, that there are things that can be done. I mean, there are, you know, I spoke with one urban planner who said something that was really fascinating to me. He talked about how difficult it was to lower the decibel level in any given urban space, even by a few decibels that would be hardly perceptible. You have to reroute traffic, and you have to get rid of HVAC systems, et cetera, et cetera. But what's not so hard is to create small, relatively contained spaces where people can find some kind of quiet refuge. You know, you can make little tiny parks with maybe a water feature and plantings that encourage biodiversity, that encourage birds to come, that birdsong is something that almost everyone finds a beneficial sort of sound. And you can make ways for people to break up the noise in their day. And I think it's vital, you know, that we both recognize the magnitude of the situation now and understand that there are things we can do as a society if we're willing to invest a little bit in trying to change the situation.
One thing that was interesting, a while back I interviewed a fellow whose name escapes me now, but he took a vow of silence for several years, and it seems as though a lot of us, even a few moments of silence now, are kind of shocking to the system. We're so unused to quiet. Does it freak some people out to be in the presence of it now?
I think that's correct, and it's another resistance to encouraging more of it. I mean, you know, I would say that silence has been largely ghettoized along two tracks right now. First, what I mentioned before about it being a privilege for the rich who can go to some resort that, that encourages silent meditation or what have you, and then within certain religious traditions. But the problem for those people who are not believers of a branch of religion that encourages silence is that silence does force people to also confront these larger abysses. At least it can raise questions. It forces you to confront yourself. I spent time in a Trappist monastery myself, and monks spoke about silence to me, about silence compelling a confrontation with the self. And this fear that silence induces prevents people from recognizing the full range and even playfulness that can also be part of what silence offers people. We have to sort of expand our notion of
it. All right, we're going to leave it there and come back and talk further with George Prochnick about why we need quiet to think deeply.
And we want to hear what you think. Is there enough quiet in your life? Where do you go to get it? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. More to come on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our conversation with George Prochnick now. He wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times recently about the need for quiet thinking space in the world. And we're getting your take on where you go when you want to find true silence and whether or not you agree that we need quiet space to think. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's pick up, George, by talking about some of the benefits of silence. We talked about some of the health effects that are negative when things are too noisy for our bodies. What's good for us about quiet?
Well, number one, certainly, I think there's, at this point, a good deal of evidence by that came out of scientific studies looking at the effects of silent meditation on people's ability to concentrate. But I think even going beyond that specific point, there's something good as a society for the whole in practicing and pursuing silence more intently. And there's a fascinating story regarding moments of silence, commemorative moments, such as many of us experience today. Those seem to have begun. It's a little bit difficult to know historically where they started, but we know that there were moments of silence following the armistice in Great Britain. Those are the first really well-documented ones. And in fact, they proved so popular that the BBC began recording just the 2 minutes of silence that marked the day. And at one point, someone was asked in the 1920s, someone at the BBC was asked, well, why is this so powerful? And this gentleman said that the silence became a solvent which destroyed personality and gave us leave to be great and universal. There was some sort of solidarity that was nurtured by silence. And I think that this is something many of us crave in our current culture, which has so much dissonance on not just politically but culturally and in so many areas. And sometimes just being together in silence is a way of feeling something larger than ourselves. It's something that brings us together as a people.
Well, I want to go to the phones. We've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you. We'll start with Eva in Hubertus. Hi, Eva.
Hi.
What do you think?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, please.
Okay. I wanted to say I really appreciate the speaker's comments on this, because I really feel, I think as a society, we have been so supercharged with noise all around us, and we have a very hard time getting down to silence, coming down off of our iPads, our iPhones, our music in the background. And I think one of the times that I've really realized this in my life is when the power would go out in our house, and you would just, and it's infrequent, maybe once a year, twice a year, but you just hear no hum in the background, and you realize how much noise is actually around you just from your daily environment in your house. And for me, my place to go and seek some of the quiet that I desire is, I think, in northern Wisconsin in the woods, and going for walks up there, going out on a sailboat and enjoying a quiet afternoon. And that really helps me psychologically to kind of achieve a balance from the noise around me, whether it's my children. I teach high school. I have a lot of noise in the building, you know, in my teaching environment. And so this is really a great topic, and I appreciate his comments. And I think in terms of the unifying thing, that's something that we would really have to train our population to go after, is to be able to have moments where we unify with silence as the unifying factor, maybe around another cause. So I will sign off at that point. Thank you.
Oh, okay. Thanks so much, Eva. George?
Well, I think those are lovely comments. And in fact, your remarks about the powerful effect of having the power go off repeats an anecdote that or echoes an anecdote that I talk about in this opinion piece. It's amazing. I spoke with a woman at one point who lived in a very remote part of Newfoundland, and she had a similar experience in her home, even though she didn't have lots of noise outside, just recognizing all of these small assaults of noise that were affecting her and her family all the time. And what a wonderful feeling it was when suddenly those were gone, when the electricity went out on one occasion. So I think that sends a message that we're being stressed even without being conscious of something as intense as, say, the passage of a jet plane. And we really need to find the sorts of oases that you were able to pursue in the woods. And I hope more people are able to make those kinds of escapes.
All right. Thank you for that call. And we move next to William calling from Merrill. Hey, William.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, what do you think?
I think, once again, thank you again for your programming. And to your guests, thank you so much for bringing up these issues. I would just like to say that I really do appreciate that bringing up both the psychological issues with noise pollution and along with that the mental aspects that happen, but I never really paid attention to the physiological aspects. But I've seen now, personally myself, I find refuge in putting a pair of headphones on and listening to music, but every now and then it is also stepping outside into a nice quiet environment and sitting down meditating that way also. But as a new father with stepchildren and a newborn, I've noticed that, you know, maybe thanks to this issue being brought up right now, maybe I should kind of delegate some minimalist time of everyone sitting down in nice, quiet, alone by themselves. I've noticed in my 8-year-old stepson that he's pretty much plugged into video games, and that's how he finds himself, whereas opposed to my little girl, she can go off to her room and play with her toys and have her own imagination, and she's bringing herself out, you know. She's not bringing she's bringing a story she's made up out, not following somebody else's story. And I think that's a great concern that we have to face, is that imagination and basically ourselves are being dwindled by, you know, other aspects around us. And I appreciate you bringing that up again. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, William. And he raises a good question. What are some baby steps that we can take toward having quiet when we're used to being kind of more plugged in?
Well, I think I also thank you for that call. I think everything you said was very eloquent. I want to respond first, though, quickly to what you said about your children. And I do encourage you to as a first step, to make sure that there is time for your son that is unplugged time, that is time where he is not being really subject to a kind of barrage of noise, which is often, it's demonstrably overwhelming for their ability to really cultivate a self. And let me just tell one quick story. I was at a friend's house recently, and they were playing Sesame Street, which I hadn't seen in many years, and it seemed so loud and so fast and so noisy in every sense. And I thought, wow, this is educational television. And I went back and I rented the very first Sesame Street made from a long time ago now. And by comparison, it seemed like Sesame Street in slow motion. It was so gentle and so human. Mm. And the children were completely engaged, but everything was at a pace that it was true to the imagination of a child. And I thought, putting these two episodes next to each other, how could children not have these problems with hyperactivity and attention issues if this is what they're subject to, even within the realm of educational television? So yes, finding ways to just give your kids a break from that, to take them outside, take them on walks, make them as much as you can unafraid of silence, and finding in silence an opportunity for different sorts of explorations.
All right, let's take one more quick call, and that's going to Shannon in Kenosha. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to share my experience. I'm an avid backpacker, and I spend a lot of time in the backcountry, in the mountains, in canyons, specifically in the Grand Canyon. And my husband and I spend a lot of time, sometimes up to 7, 10, 12 days out with our backpacks. And after a few days away from the noise, the silence begins to have a fullness to it. And it's actually kind of disconcerting when you come back to the rim and to the busyness and where all the tourists are usually congregated. And it can almost be a bit of a stressful experience after having been out in the silence for so many days, coming back into the normal activity of life.
All right. Thank you so much for that, Shannon. And George, you've got about a minute for your response.
Well, it's another powerful story that you've told, and it reminds me of a comment by Thoreau, who said that silence has different depths and fertility, like soil. And that sense of fullness you describe is a presence. I mean, and that's one other thing that I would encourage people to recognize. Looking for more silence in your life is not looking for the void. It's not looking for emptiness. In fact, it's looking to be more aware of all the smaller sounds and all the beautiful, more lyrical sounds that fill the world, if only they're not washed over by these intense man-made infrastructure noises, commercial noises, entertainment noises. You know, pursuing silence for me is really about hearing more, not hearing less. It's just about hearing things that are more delicate and enriching. And it's no wonder to me that you would come back and find something stressful in returning to the environment that we've allowed to become, in many cases, kind of a sonic dumping ground, I'm afraid.
Well, George, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
We've been talking to George Prochnik, the author of the book In Pursuit of Silence.
Coming up, we'll find out how museums are making the transition to the online world with the director of the Smithsonian.
This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time.
Our next guest has written a call to action for museums, libraries, and archives. He says there's a generation of digital natives who bring a huge appetite and aptitude for the digital world, and it's time for these institutions to start meeting their needs or lose relevance.
Joining us now is the secretary of the Smithsonian Institute, Wayne Clough. He's written a new free ebook called Best of Both Worlds, Museums, Libraries, and Archives in a Digital Age. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Wayne, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure, Rob. Veronica, glad to be with you.
Well, how is the role of museums changing in the internet age, and are they keeping up?
Well, it's a struggle for museums because they typically don't have a deep technological bench and set of resources to tackle these things. But at the same time, it's a huge opportunity area because it can increase their relevance substantially, not only in terms of enhancing the true physical visit, which I think will continue to people will continue to want, but offering educational materials to people they've never reached before and people who might not go to museums ordinarily.
Well, one interesting opportunity when I dig deep into what's going on in a museum, I always hear that whether we're talking art, science, you name it, there's a big part of their collection out there that's not on exhibit to the public. Let's start there. How can museums use the internet to start bringing the rest of that material off the bench and onto our screens?
Well, that's a good point. And at the Smithsonian, we take that particularly seriously because we have 137 million objects in our collections. And obviously, we can't put all those on display. And in some cases, they're scientific collections, and so you wouldn't have them all on display ordinarily anyway. But digitally, you can make, I think, decisions about what the public really wants and work with the public in terms of letting us know what they want. And you can digitize your collections and make them available to people. The challenge is not only coming up with high-quality digital images, particularly for three-dimensional objects in your collections, but also to provide what is technically called the metadata or the information supporting the object. Where did it come from? When was it developed? Who painted it or who developed it and so forth? That's the hard part. And we're actually finding that a lot of people who want to be digital volunteers to help us do exactly that. So we're looking to crowdsource this as much as we can.
That was one of the fascinating things, because I think you make the argument in your book that by putting some of these things online, there are people out there who might know things that even the Smithsonian doesn't and can help you out with categorizing and archiving it online.
Absolutely. And we've found that there's we now have a volunteer website that we're putting up. We just run a beta test on it, and we had so many people volunteer, we were just floored. And so what we do is offer people opportunities to participate with us. We have 19 museums and galleries and a series of research centers. So we're going to offer them opportunities to volunteer digitally in any of these different areas, depending on their interest.
And you mentioned your collection has over 170 million items. You only want to start by digitizing just 14 million. That still sounds pretty ambitious to me.
It is ambitious, and we're actually exploring robotics and other techniques to be able to do some of these things. Here again, volunteers can help us. Volunteers can come out on the weekends and help us with some of our digitization. We are also looking at third parties to do it, because museums aren't staffed up to do this, and there are organizations that do this as a matter of course. And they return the images to you for some sort of pro bono comments or quid pro quo type of relationship for a period of time with the digital images themselves.
Are we talking 3D for all 14 million, or is that just a portion of those?
There's some that you will do 3D for. That's obviously a more sophisticated technology at this point in time. But we have really had a lot of fun with that here at the Smithsonian. And you not only can create a 3D image file for some fascinatingly iconic object, and you know we have examples of that here, like the gunboat Philadelphia, which was at the Battle of Lake Champlain, prevented the British from coming down into the United States. And this gunboat was like a kamikaze plane of its time. It had one small cannon on it. They were all sunk, but this one was brought up. And very few people see that. And we actually have digitally imaged that now, and you can see it on the Internet. Put it on your iPad, turn it around. But in addition, you can send this image file to a school. And if the school has a fairly decent 3D printer, they can actually print a version of the object out right in front of the students.
Wow, that sounds fun. Now, another behind-the-scenes thing, apart from the collection that's not out for public display, you talk about the work that people at a museum like the Smithsonian are doing that you know we don't see when we're just walking through the museum. What kind of things can you put online?
Well, I think that's the fascinating part about it. When I came to the Smithsonian, I was not a museum person. I came out of the university world. And I got to meet the people who were working in collections, the people who, at the Smithsonian, we have a huge scientific core who travel all over the world to do paleontological work, anthropological work. And I got to talk to these people, and I said, this is fascinating what you're doing. People will want to know this. And so the simple technique is to just do YouTube videos with these folks and be able to distribute it that way. But we can now take people actually on field trips with us. They can participate with us in classifying specimens that we bring back from some of our expeditions. And you can walk right into the collection center and see exactly what the conservator, the scientist, the scholar is doing in the collections. And to me, how you do this work is just as fascinating as what comes out of it.
Are you bringing classes, students from around the country, university or high school, to help crowdsource some of these things?
Absolutely. And, you know, obviously, speaking of someone who is, let's say, a little more mature, young at heart, shall we say, we know that some of the young people out there are much more adept at using technologies than we will ever be. And so we have a very large intern program here at the Smithsonian, and it's approaching 1,500 students a year. And more we're bringing in youngsters here who want to do things in the digital space, and they're helping us get our materials out to their colleagues. They know how they think. They know how they want to access things. And so we're relying very much on young people to help guide us in how we deliver this to people. Now, in addition, we have now platforms where people can actually leave their stories with us. They can interact with our scientists, interact with our conservators, and talk to them. So it's really turning the museum world inside out.
Part of the mission here, I guess, is providing more access. I've been lucky enough to be to the Smithsonian a few times. A lot of people may not be able to afford to make the trip. Is that part of what you're getting at here, trying to reach out to those people as well?
Very much so. I grew up in a rural community in South Georgia, and I didn't know the Smithsonian existed hardly until I was in my late teens and early 20s. And yet my parents, who were taxpayers, were helping pay for the Smithsonian because we are partly supported by the federal government. And I think it's an obligation of ours to make this the resources of this amazing institution available to all Americans. And the digital process allows us to do that, not just in a static or passive voice of God sort of way, but in a way that allows people to interact with us and tell us their stories. We have an exhibition coming up on agricultural heritage. We have many objects in our collections about this, but we have allowed people to leave their stories of growing up on a farm in different parts of the country, and that has been a very rich source of information to inform the exhibition. So people taking part in our creative processes is what's happening today.
Now, the title of your free ebook is Best of Both Worlds. You're looking into how the actual physical museum and the digital manifestation complement each other. Talk about how they interact and relate.
Well, the visitation to museums is at an almost all-time high, and at the Smithsonian it is. We're over 30 million visitors a year to our museum. So people love to come to museums. It's a family experience. It's a shared experience. And there's nothing like seeing the real thing. Seeing the Star-Spangled Banner, there's nothing like seeing the real Star-Spangled Banner. You can't recreate that digitally. And so the physical visit, I think, will always be important. And you can actually enhance that visit by providing information before the visit. You can actually have different types of technologies that make it easier for people to understand what they're seeing when they're here, and they can continue to learn after they leave. But clearly, digitally, we can reach those people who can't afford to go to a museum, don't have the time to go to a museum, or are in communities that aren't normally reached by museums, like rural communities and some groups, minority groups that traditionally have not seen themselves reflected in the collections of museums.
The Smithsonian is not alone in doing these things. A lot of other museums around the country, libraries too, are involved in this. Isn't it expensive, though? Isn't that a stumbling block for you at the big level down to the local library, local museum?
It is, and we spend a lot of time talking to our colleagues. You have a rich array of museums in Madison. It's very impressive. And I'm sure every one of them is struggling with this very same type of challenge. But we have 180 museums or so that are what we call affiliates for the Smithsonian. And we spend a lot of time with them, learning from them and helping them and providing them with information as well. So we're all learning about this together. We will all, you know, the fact of the matter is, if you settle on a technology today, it'll be changed next year. And so you've got to be adaptive. It's not easy. It's not going to be cheap. You have to find a way to do it. We think that our visitors will start supporting us in this effort, just like in some cases people charge admission. We don't. But we think people will be willing to support us financially. Donors will do that. Foundations will do it. And we'll find volunteers to help us get our work done. We have 6,000 volunteers at the Smithsonian. We couldn't do what we do without them. But we might have 100,000 digital volunteers in the future who will help us get our work done more quickly than we would otherwise.
Wayne, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure.
Wayne Clough is the secretary of the Smithsonian Institute. He mentioned the Star-Spangled Banner. Just heard a rumor that this Friday is the anniversary of the Star-Spangled Banner. Funny, that came up twice in a day.
And Rob will be singing his own rendition of that on Friday. I look forward to that.
I shan't be doing that. We'd like people to continue listening to the show.
Coming up next, we'll look at what it means to grow up today for working-class young adults. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.